portion of the TechNet to see that Roy has 100% of his audio. K2RIW, KU3J.
The amount of time that Roy was transmitting up until now, tonight, is way beyond the time where we would have heard those dropouts. Sounds like you finally found where the dropouts were coming from. Although it may be a little bit of a speculation. What do you believe it was? It sounds like you solved that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, tonight will be the proof of the pudding. The thing that clued me into it is I was up there the last week. I had Angie listen with me, and I found it deserving itself, though. That's not happening anymore.
So the fact that the front end was getting a lack of proper isolation, 60 dB of isolation, was an aggravating factor, so that the minor glitches on top of that building would create a dropout, and it would, the dropout was where your voting system thought that that particular channel had degraded in signal-to-noise ratio compared to another channel, and it flipped over to the other channel, and during the flip is when we were getting the dropout. That's my guess. Am I close? Over to you, Eric.
On the experiment while Roy was doing his thing, was to just leave it on to one receiver and you can actually see the signal go away. The other interesting thing is I can see the AGC and EIN. I can see the what they call RSSI, or Receive Signal Strength Number, in the form of a graph. And the other duplex tube, by the way, you could actually see the AGC being driven up, even though there was no input. You can see the leakage from the transmitter into the receiver side. Now, you see nothing, which is really nice.
I think you're saying when you turn on and off the transmitter, you used to see RSSI, Receiver Signal Strength Indicator, going up and down, as well as if you were measuring a weak signal-to-noise ratio, you'd see the signal-to-noise ratio change with transmitter on and off. So you were, with 60 dB of isolation, experiencing an easily measurable amount of desensitization. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
That's exactly right, but there's still one question in my mind, because when I put it over to the hospital's receiver, I could still see Roy's signal making little variations, and it would drop out there, so I don't know. We'll see what happens.
There could have been some excessive voting going on, even though you think you were only going over to that receiver. At the hospital receiver, is there anything there that could create desense, Eric? Go ahead.
I suppose, but the hospital receiver's got a filter in front of it, and it's connected to an antenna. The output of that system is a different frequency altogether, a different band. That's got its own antenna, which is maybe about 50 feet away from the receive antenna. So, I don't know. Well, at least I know that what I'm seeing in terms of what's happening with the Glen Oaks receiver, I don't see that happening anymore. That would happen last night on not just on Roy's signal, but on other people's signal and weak signal especially.
Concerning the equipment that's located at the hospital, is there any duplexing filter in operation over there, Eric?
It's that. It goes in on 2.5 and comes out complete else on another band. And they're separate antennas. There's no duplexes involved.
So there's diplexing, but not duplexing. Therefore, there shouldn't be any dropout. It can't be happening. You only think you're seeing it. Next person on our list, I'm going to go back to Dave one more time. Whiskey 2, Alpha, Alpha, Mike. If you're there, Dave, go right ahead, K2RIW.
Okay, there we go. I hear myself coming out of the radio. Name is Dave. I'm in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, checking in via Echolink this evening, and I got kind of a theoretical question for you. I know that a radio wave gradually diminishes in strength, of course, due to the law of inverse squares, and one night I was messing around on the internet and found one of those sites. I think it was the Pasternak cable site or one of the other engineering sites that had a RF distance calculator. where you plugged in your frequency and you plugged in various other parameters, like how many dB gain of the receiver, the dB gain of the transmitter, and you could measure the signal strength at the other end of your theoretical path. And I took a... this left it in an interesting experiment. I took exact same characteristics. Now, this is just a theory, of course. The exact same characteristics, same antenna gain at 2 meters, same antenna gain at 432, same power, same receiver gain at both bands, and noticed a less of a signal with the 432 than the 2 meters. Now, what causes that? Is it just the higher frequency causes more attenuation, or what? What is the physical cause of all this stuff? Maybe I didn't give the question clearly, but I'm kind of theoretically trying to understand this stuff. Over.
Not to worry, Dave. You made it very clear. And you've asked a question that I think 80% of the amateurs would have trouble understanding it. Why does the apparent free space loss go up with frequency squared? If I double the frequency, I've got the two identical antennas. So let's make it simple. I've got an isotropic antenna, 0 dB of gain on the transmitting end, and a 0 dB gain on the receiving end, and a fixed distance between the two. Let me call it a mile. And I make the measurement at 100 megacycles. Or I calculate it at 100 megacycles. Then I go to 200 megacycles, and I'll get 4 times less power, 6 dB less power, at twice the frequency. It goes up with frequency squared. Why in the world is that happening? And it isn't because the space in between is really more lossy. We call it free space loss. And the calculated free space loss goes up. But you could do a laboratory experiment with very accurate instrumentation, and you would find the air between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna runs ice cold. It's not dissipating any energy. Let me drop. And let me give you a simple example. I've got a 100-watt light bulb in the middle of a room, a spherical room that has 100 square meters of area, something like a 6-foot diameter or something like that. Room will have 100 square meters of area. So 100-watt light bulb and a room that's 100 square meters. I could do a careful measurement. I would find out each individual square meter is picking up 1 watt of the power out of that 100-watt light bulb. There's 100 of those square meters, if you know what I mean. And if I went down to a smaller area, like a quarter of a square meter, I would measure a quarter of a watt. When you take an antenna like a dipole, 0.13 lambda squared, that's the amount of area, the effective area of a dipole, or is it isotropic? I think it's a dipole, 0.13. Take the wavelength of your antenna, square it, multiply it by 0.13. That is the effective area of that antenna as a receiver. Happens to be true also as a transmitter. You go to twice the frequency. Your dipole is half the length. Half the length in width, and your eye doesn't see it, but it has an equivalent half the length in height. It has one quarter of the area. The area of the receiving antenna is what became smaller. Even though the gain is the same, the pattern is the same. But the area goes down as a function of frequency squared. Let me drop. So it's the decrease in area of the receiving antenna at the higher frequency that makes the apparent free space loss go up. The loss didn't go up. You just lowered the area of your receiving site. You got less area. You went to a quarter square meter of the room instead of a 1 square meter of the room when you're measuring the power output of that light bulb. You caused it, if you know what I mean. The air didn't do it. And when it comes to calculating one of the questions you can ask a zillion amateurs, and very few of them would be comfortable with the answer. I know I've got 100 watts going into this dipole on top of a mountain, and 1 mile away I got another mountain with the exact same dipole, and I know I'm putting 100 watts into this antenna. How much signal am I going to get out of the other antenna at the receiver site? Very few amateurs have a comfortable feel for giving that answer. And the elaborate solution would go back to the radar range equation, which got about 10 terms, and fill in the 10 terms and do a calculation. Is a much easier approach. Let me drop it. and that is do a divide and conquer. First, calculate what is the free space loss at that frequency for isotropic antennas, and then add and subtract the gain of your transmitting and receiving antennas. That's a simple offset. And then add a fudge factor because of the ground reflection and multipath reflection. Add a fudge factor that can go up and down. So when it comes to free space loss, it's a fairly simple formula. I recommend you memorize or write it down somewhere and put it on a notepad on the wall, if you know what I mean. Insertion loss, free space loss, in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 times log of F plus 20 times log of D. F is frequency in megahertz, D is distance in miles. So you add those three factors together, 36.6 plus the log of F and the log of D, each multiplied by 20, added together. Now you know the free space loss for simple antennas between those two sites. Add and subtract the gain of your real antennas and the fudge factor for multipath, and you come up with an extremely good answer. When I use that crazy formula to calculate how strong is the signal going to be from the Voyager spacecraft launched in 1977, 12 billion miles away from us, three times the distance to Pluto. Let me drop. I calculated the free space loss of those 12 billion miles. I know that they're using a 12-foot diameter dish antenna at 8.5 gigs. I can calculate the gain of the transmitting antenna. I think it's like 43 dB. I know they're listening to it with the Goldstone dish in California, 230 feet in diameter. I calculate the gain of that. I calculate the signal strength that they get at 12 billion miles with 37 hours of round-trip transmission time. And I came up with an fraction of a dB of the right number. It turns out to be something like 317 dB of free space loss. Ain't that crazy? With a number that big, you'd think you could be wrong by a zillion dB. Came out within a fraction of a dB of the right answer. That formula works. Over to you, Dave. I wonder if now you see where the so-called free space loss, why it goes up when you go up in frequency. W2 Alpha Alpha Mike. By the way, your website, QRZ.com, beautiful looking shack you got. K2RIW, you got it, Dave.
Okay, first of all, Dick, the call is N2AAM, November 2 Alpha Alpha Mike, and I don't have a QRZ webpage, so I think you're in error there, but I understand now as far as the frequency and the free space path loss and so on. It's just one of those questions that I always never really got a cogent answer on, and this is the first time tonight that I've actually been able to get a cogent answer on, so thanks a lot for that. And I've been listening to your tech notes for years and always find them interesting. And that's about it for now. Thank you very much, and good evening to everybody on the net. I'm going to duck out, and thanks a lot for satiating my curiosity this week, Dick. K2RIW, this is N2AAM, clear, 7-3.
Yeah, sorry, I got your call. That is wrong, Dave. Sounds like we got a satisfied customer there, Dave and Paul. We're going to have to send him a bill. That's a joke. Yeah, we thought that in 1982, when the TechNet was first formed, we'd be around for a couple of weeks answering people's questions. We'd dry up and go away. Here we are, 36 and a fraction years downrange, and there's new hams, fans of ham radio, and it keeps going on. Steve's the next guy. KD2HUC. Go right ahead, Steve, with your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
H6D with a comment.
Good evening, Dick. My question tonight is regarding ground-mounted verticals, and it's more of a theoretical question. Would there be anything stopping me from taking a ground-mounted vertical, like a butternut 26-foot long radiator, and mounting it on the peak of my roof, and instead of mounting the radials along the ground, going along the underside of the roof along the rafters to fake it out with a ground plane? Would that work? Would I suffer any performance loss? What's your opinion on that? KD2HUC, back to net.
A6DPZ with a comment.
One of the things I noticed, Steve, is that you're transmitting on the 975-375 input from COMAC. I'm a little bit amazed that you're not using the 2585, but that you've done the test. You know which signal comes out stronger. When it comes to a dipole-like antenna, we all know what that looks like. Picture a dipole in free space. At one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, the left-hand side is negative, and a half cycle later, we reverse. That dipole is a thoroughly independent antenna. It's got its own local ground, so to speak. Your transmitter, if you were feeding it with twin leads, you're pumping some current into the right side, taking the exact same amount of current out of the left-hand side during this half cycle. Thoroughly balanced antenna. Requires no grounding, no connection to anything else. Works like a charm. In free space, an astronaut is 200 miles above the Earth, holding this dipole in his hand, and it's going to test it, and he's going to be very happy with the way it works. At each instant of time, because the right side is positive and left side is negative, you could put a sheet of metal at right angles to that dipole, right down the middle, an infinite sheet of metal. You would make no change to the gain, the impedance, nothing would change, because that's the balance point, that's the neutral plane, so to speak. Let me drop it. Once you realize that that sheet of metal has no effect on the dipole, you can then decide, I'm going to throw away half the dipole. The left-hand side, I'm going to throw it away. I'm going to use the right-hand side against that sheet of metal. We then call that a ground plate antenna. The other half of the dipole is there as a mirror image in that sheet of metal. The right-hand side doesn't know anything has changed. So that's an infinite sheet of metal. Now we come along and use some number of radials, each radio a quarter wavelength long, doing a skeleton poor man's equivalent of that infinite sheet of metal. As long as each one of those radials is a resonant length, quarter wave long, the antenna will give you 95% of the performance you had with the infinite sheet of metal. And if you bend those radials down a little bit, you get a little bit better impedance match. When you use the dipole all by itself was 73 ohms. When you use the infinite sheet of metal and half the dipole, you measure half that, 37 ohms. And so if you bend the radials down, you can come back to 50 ohms. Now, those radials there, you can put those radials in the air. I mean, your station master antenna with those radials in the air 100 feet above the ground work like a charm. Let me drop. You can bring that antenna all the way down to the ground. And life gets a little bit more complicated. The Earth is a complex material. It's a volumetric material that's got a resistivity and a reactance to it, so to speak. So it's adding some capacitance. The exact length of the radials to give you optimum performance when it's measured, or when it's located exactly above the ground, in theory you should change the length a little bit. And the RF energy that falls between the radials that sees the Earth, start seeing the Earth as a dummy load. So ground plane radials of a ground plane antenna against the Earth is going to be a little bit more lossy. And the guys who have run the experiment, when they find out, as they put more and more ground plane radios, all the way up to 32 of them, you're now simulating that infinite sheet of metal. And the efficiency of the antenna goes up as you do that. So anything to put your ground plane radios above the Earth, where the RF energy has less chance to see this volumetric, resistive, absorptive material called Earth, anything that raises the antenna above the ground gives you a double advantage. Higher efficiency of the ground plane radial system. You're not putting RF energy into that Earth, and your point of transmission is higher above the ground. You get a lower angle of radiation. So anything to raise those radials above the ground is usually an advantage. Let me drop. Now, in the case of mounting those radials near the gutters and downspout and the household wiring, life gets a little bit more complicated. Local chunks of metal add some capacitance to those radials. And so if you wanted to do a super exact job, you could re-measure the exact resonant frequency of each one of those radials because of the material of your house that's nearby. You could do that. And you'd pick up a couple of tenths of a dB in the process, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't worry about it. So I think that's part of the question you're asking. And if that's not leading you in the right direction, go ahead and re-ask the question some more, Steve. KD2HUC. He uses 975-375 from COMAC, KQRIW. Go ahead, Steve.
I happen to be in my basement, and my radio down here is on an Omni. I have trouble receiving on the Glen Oaks machine on this antenna. Normally I'm on my upstairs and I have a beam that's pointed right at Glen Oaks, so I would come in on the 850 machine. But when I'm down here, this has to work. Okay, so barring any metallic interference, gutters, wiring, so on and so forth, really, you're saying that mounting it on the peak and then putting the radials on the underside of the roof probably will give me better performance than mounting it on the ground because the earth is not present amongst those radials. Am I understanding that right?
Give that man a cigar. You've got it right. You're picking up a double advantage. With the ground plane antenna on the roof of your house, it's higher above the earth, lower angle of radiation, and the signal going into those ground plane radials is further away from the earth, less of it's sucking up that signal. You're going to be pouring a little bit of signal inside of the house. And by the way, those ground plane radials, whether or not you lay them on the top of the roof, because they're not that visible, particularly if they're painted the right color, whether or not you lay them on top of the roof or put them underneath the roof, that's your choice. That's a weatherproofing and your choice. Radio-wise, they would be essentially the same. And the nearby wiring of the house and the gutters and downspouts, that's a very minor perturbation. And let me give you an example of that. Let me drop. I'm setting up my 20-meter dipole between my two trees. And I'm setting it up 60 feet above the ground, parallel to the ground. And in the direction toward Europe, where I want to talk to somebody in London, in that direction happens to be directly across the street from me, the Loco and Con Ed power wiring, or PSENG wiring. And it's horizontal wire, exactly 60 feet above the ground. You and I look at that with our eye, and we say, gee, that wiring is creating a shadow in exactly the direction I want to operate my dipole. Boy, that's going to really kill the signal toward England. And the answer is absolutely not. If that wiring of that Con Ed or PSENG wiring happens to be your resonant length, yes, it's going to be a substantial blockage, a substantial effective capture area. A piece of wire that is not resonant, that's, let me pick a number, an eighth of an inch in diameter, has extremely little area if it's not resonant. The effective capture area of an 80-meter dipole is 8,500 square feet. If your eye operated at 80 meters and you look at your resonant dipole in free space, you'd see a great big black hole in space with the dipole in the middle of it. And that black hole would be one and a quarter wavelengths wide and a third of a wavelength high. It would be a great big oval in space, 8,500 square feet. That wiring across the street that's non-resonant has 1 square foot of area across that length that you care about. If you did the experiment with the wiring across the street there and not there, and you made a careful measurement of the signal picked up in London, they would see an amount of difference in signal strength that you couldn't measure. So when you look at it correctly, your downspout wiring and all the wiring of your house and your gutters, they are not resonant. And even though they've got a number...
Repeater, timeout.
Even though those pieces of metal have a number of inches of width to them, and they look like a great big blockage, they are not. If they're not resonant, compared to an 80-meter dipole, 8,500 square feet, 0.13 lambda squared is the effective area, or 4 pi a over lambda squared. You go to either one of those formulas. You plug in the formula for the wavelength you're operating at. You'd be amazed what is the real effective capture area of a high-frequency antenna on an HF band. And so your eye doesn't see it when you're looking at that wire. That radio wave does see it. The portion of that radio wave that's a foot above that wire and a foot below that wire, inside of that black oval in space, essentially all of that energy ends up going onto that wire, going down your feed line, and moving the S-meter on your receiver. So as a radar engineer, when you calculate effective capture area of pieces, or what they call radar cross-section, how much echo would I get off that wiring across the street if I really did a radar experiment? If it's a non-resonant object, and it doesn't have a whole lot of great big square area like a water tower, you'd be amazed how small is the area of blockage or the area of interference or the radar cross-section and so on of pieces of metal that are non-resonant. Opposite of common sense. do the experiment, you'll be very pleasantly surprised. KD2HUC, K2LAW. Go ahead, Steve.
WSLM, quick question on that.
We'll go over to Steve first and then go over to a poll right after that. Go ahead, Steve.
Sounds like it's a win, especially considering I don't have any wiring up by the roof. And like you pointed out, the chances of the gutters being resonant, slim to none. Sounds like it's a winning installation, rather than putting it down in the small yard that I have. Sounds like the way to go. KD2HUC, back to net.
A real antenna has some real area to it because of resonance. And remember the thing that I keep saying, the seven most important words to you as an antenna engineer are, you resonate first, then it will radiate. I don't care if your dipole is infinitesimal in length, the dipole is supposed to be 132 feet long at 80 meters, and you've made it 32 feet long. But with a fancy tuning network in the middle of the dipole, you've brought it back into electronic resonance. You'll have full performance within half a dB when you do that. You resonate first, then it will radiate. So a real antenna with real area, the area comes from resonance. The extraneous pieces of metal on your property will only create significant shadow and significant echo if they are resonant. The antenna area goes, and that area echo relationship, when you've got a Yagi antenna on 6 meters and a 2 meter Yagi above it, and each of those frequencies are non-resonant, each of those antennas are non-resonant on the other frequency. They do not see each other. You can mount them amazingly close, and they don't interfere and don't create any detriment. Resonance is where it all happens. Ain't that magic? And none of the good books I read, none of the classes that I talk about, use those words. Resonance is the magic. WS2N, K2IW. He's going to ask a question about some more of this magic. Go ahead, Paul.
I just want to get to the next step. I know you've explained this in the past, but I've forgotten. Why is this 132-foot halfway 80-meter dipole take up 8,500 feet? You know, it's only maybe a 12-gauge wire, and I'm running 132 feet. I can see the reflection off the ground, but you're only reflecting one little wire off the ground. So, you know, where do you get that? What's the physics behind that? I know it is, you know, the formula and everything, but, you know, what's the logic behind that? Back to you, Dick.
If you are using your time domain reflectometer, your network analyzer, vector network analyzer, all this instrumentation, you carefully study what happens in this situation. I've got a 100-watt transmitter. I'm feeding it with 73-ohm balanced twin lead transmission line going into the center of a 80-meter dipole, which has an impedance of 73 ohms. So I'm putting 100 watts down the transmission line into the dipole. The dipole is made out of 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long. And I do a whole bunch of experiments in the time domain and whatever, and some of this is going to be a thought experiment, but you could do various experiments to confirm what I'm about to say. Each individual cycle coming out of that transmitter produces a sine wave that walks down that transmission line. The sine wave hits the wire. The sine wave starts going down the wire, positive on the right-hand side, negative on the left-hand side, and so on. The transmission line is balanced. At one instant of time, the right side is the positive voltage, the left side is the negative voltage on that half cycle. Then you study what happens to that wave by doing the following. You've got this transmitter and transmission line and dipole running continuously for a long period of time, and by some magic, all of those electrons coming out of the transmitter are blue, but for the very next cycle, you make sure that all the electrons out of the next cycle are red, and you watch the red electrons, one cycle of them, go down that transmission line, and you watch them spread out on that wire. And you ask the average antenna engineer what happens next. Let me drop it. And the answer is the red electrons go down the wire. The wire on the right side is a quarter wavelength long. As they travel down that wire, a quarter wavelength, roughly 5% of the energy gets radiated into space. It comes to the open end of the dipole and reflects back because there's nothing more to go down there. And then it reflects back. It's only 5% weaker, and on the way back another 5% is radiated. And it comes back to the beginning because it took a half wavelength of wire to go down there and a half wavelength to come back. When the reflected signal comes back, it's 180 degrees out of phase with the very next blue cycle of electrons coming out of that transmitter and transmission line. 180 degrees out of phase. It thinks it sees a short circuit. Therefore, it gets re-reflected out toward the tip of the dipole again. The bottom line is that your red electrons bounce back and forth 10 times before the majority of them are radiated. The antenna being resonant, the word resonant means that each cycle is in step with the previous cycle in the way the dipole is behaving. That resonance means they're all in step with each other. They're complementing each other. The signal bounces back and forth. Because it bounces back and forth 10 times, and because there's blue ones coming on the next cycle doing the same thing, the bottom line of all this is that the current in the center of that dipole is 10 times higher than the current that you're issuing out of that transmission line. The antenna, the signal is bouncing back and forth 10 times. You could say the antenna has a Q of 10. A dipole is roughly a Q of 10. You can measure that by the rise time, the bandwidth, the loss per cycle. There's five different ways you can measure the Q. But the signal bounces back and forth 10 times. One of the definitions of Q is the current rise at resonance. Another definition of Q is...
Repeater, timeout.
Another definition of Q is the voltage rise at resonance. You do a careful measurement of the signal coming down the transmission line in volts, and you measure the voltage between the tips of that dipole. The voltage at the tips of the dipole will be 10 times higher. Measure the current of the signal coming down that transmission line, and you carefully measure the current near the center of the dipole. The current will be 10 times higher. The 10 times higher current is making a big, strong, local magnetic field. That's what really gets radiated. Or you could, if you want to, say the voltage being 10 times higher at the tip of the dipole, and that's what's getting radiated. It takes a combination of the two. But resonance makes the current higher by the value called Q, makes the voltage higher by the value called Q. That great big strong magnetic field, because of 10 times higher current, creates that extra area. By the way, you called it 8,500 feet of length. No, it's 8,500 square feet of area. That great big, if your eyes operated at that frequency and you looked at that antenna in free space, you would see a great big black oval around that dipole, and you add up the, you take the width and the height of that ellipse and use the usual formula, A, B, pi, I think it is. Width times length times pi is the area of your, or maybe it's half the width, but there's a formula for the area of an ellipse, and you'll come out with 8,500 square feet, or 0.13 lambda squared. You'll come up with it that way, or 4 pi A over lambda squared. A is pi lambda squared over 4 pi. There's various ways you can calculate, measure, and whatever. It's that strong magnetic field around that piece of 14-gauge wire that's making that antenna, as far as effective capture area, the wire is 132 feet long. You will think that that oval is 150 feet wide and 75 feet high.
Repeater, timeout.
Numbers like that. You will think that oval is 75 feet high and 150 feet wide. You could make a tiny little transistorized transmitter located somewhere within the area of that ellipse that I just described, and measure how much signal is being picked up by that dipole. And you would find out that effective capture area really is there. Your eye doesn't see it. The radio wave does see it if the structure is resonant. WS2N, K2I, W, Grand Pole. I know this sounds strange the first time you hear it.
HUC with a question.
Very well done. Okay. I like that, Dick. I like the red and blue electrons. I like the magnetic field. The answer really is magnetic field. Yeah, that's an easier concept to grab, this massive magnetic field that surrounds that wire. Very well done. And you heard, there was somebody else there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Steve is about to stump us with a tough question. Wait for the beeps and you got it, Steve.
Dick, before when you said if you measure the voltage at the tips of the dipole, it'll be 10 times the voltage that you're putting into the antenna, and the current in the middle would be 10 times that which you're putting into it, does that change based upon the distance from the transmitter? Like if there's only a quarter wave versus half wave length of transmission line, will the location on the antenna where those measurements can be made change? KD2HUC, back to net.
Good question, Steve, and the answer is no. Assuming your transmission line is low in loss, whether it's 10 feet long, 100 feet long, or 10 miles long, if it's low enough in loss, the signal you're applying to the center of the dipole is the exact same signal strength. And how you would actually make this measurement? You would suspend your dipole some reasonable length above ground, because you're going to be making the measurement while you're on the earth, and then by a voltage probing device that you put near the tip of the dipole on the right side. And you have to be quite far away from it, so you're not adding extra capacitance and changing the resonance of the dipole. So you've got some kind of a voltage probing device, and you measure the voltage between the right-hand side of the dipole and ground. And if you want to do a really thorough experiment, you simultaneously have another voltage probing device measuring the left-hand side of the dipole, voltage to ground. You do that experiment, and because of the distance between your probe and the actual tip of the wire, you use a formula that allows you to figure out the ratio. I mean, if the real voltage on the tip of the dipole is 1,000 volts, but you're making the measurement from 20 feet away, maybe your probe is only going to pick up 10 volts. But there's ways of calibrating that. So in other words, you're doing an experiment where you're doing a very minor perturbation of the original device, and by ratios of the voltage you measure versus the voltage that would have had been there to give that response of your voltage probing device, you calculate what is the voltage really there. You do that, and if there's 1,000 volts between the tips of the dipole, from the right-hand side to ground, you'll measure 500 volts. From the left-hand side to ground, you measure 500 volts, 180 degrees out of phase, and you'll figure out. And you could do the experiment really in free space, where you've got some kind of a mechanism that you're holding 100 feet away, and it's got a great big spread between two voltage probes. One voltage probe is nearer the right side, and the other voltage probe is nearer the left side, and you measure the difference between the voltage.
Repeater, timeout.
There's a billion ways you can do that experiment, and some people have done that. And you can put a little bit of a very small loop of wire around the center of your dipole, a little bit to the right of the feed point, a little bit to the left of the feed point. And by measuring the current flowing through that little bitty loop, you'll figure out what is the current flowing through the center of the dipole. You'll find that's 10 times higher for a full half-wave dipole of the normal construction, a Q of 10. And so Q has got at least five different definitions: voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, energy dissipated per cycle versus energy stored per cycle, rise time, fall time. You go through the five different definitions, you'll come up with the right same number, a Q of 10 roughly, for a dipole, and you think there's 10 different parameters you're measuring. They're all related by the exact same phenomenon, resonance. You're continuously pouring energy into that dipole, the energy is bouncing back and forth, but as it travels down the wire, it's being slowly radiated, if you know what I mean, on each of those 10 cycles. And 10 cycles is just where you get the majority of the energy radiated. It really takes a zillion cycles for all of that, all of those red electrons to completely become dissipated, if you know what I mean. But you've got to make some kind of a definition. If the energy goes down to 1 over E, I call that the time constant, if you know what I mean, and takes 10 bounces for that to happen. So I wonder if you're getting a little bit more of a picture of the magic of resonance, effective areas, and you look at antennas this way, as a good radar engineer does, you get an entirely different slant about how antennas work and how nearby interfering pieces of conductor and non-conductor, what they do. KD2HUC, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Yes, thank you for explaining it. It's a little bit clearer. Each time I hear it, it gets a little clearer. KD2HUC, back to net.
Now, let me give you a caveat. After 40 years of exposure to all kinds of crazy antennas at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, continuously working with transmitters and receivers and antennas, and working with the 30-some-odd engineers they had in the antenna engineering department, I've come up with a bunch of rules of thumb that work for me. Each of these little mental pictures as to how the current flows, how resonance happens, where the effective capture area of an antenna comes from, where does the free space loss come from. All of these are mental pictures I've come up with, rules of thumb, that work for me. I've used them on a large number of experiments and projects I've worked on, and they work. They are different from anything you'll read in any of the normal textbooks. It's different from the information you're going to hear when you're standing in front of an electrical engineering professor who's teaching you Maxwell's equations. You're not going to hear any of this stuff there. It works for me. I think it has high accuracy because I have found it not to fail. But because it is so non-conventional, is it traceable to the Bureau of Standards? Probably not. Be careful how you use it. As I said, for 40-some-odd years, it has worked for me. Hopefully, it'll keep working for you. But if you try to confirm it with the respected textbooks and the respected instructors, they're going to think you're crazy. Okay, we've gone down the list of people who asked questions for our crazy set of information tonight. We're going to go over now to the science talk. And Roy gave me a list of what he's going to be talking about tonight. He's got some exciting stuff. By the way, one of the things NASA has recently written about is they found out that when you put an astronaut in space into microgravity, weightless conditions, for a period of time, like a year, measure all kinds of changes to that human being. Let me drop this. You get the calcium loss in his bones. You get changes in his blood. They're discovering that the brain changes also. The percentage of cerebral fluid increases. The amount of gray matter decreases. I mean, all kinds of changes happen into a human brain, into a human body, when you put them into the higher radiation exposure and zero gravity experiment. Human beings were not designed for the International Space Station to be there for a year. So a number of detrimental things happen. Some of those things are partially corrected over the next couple of years when you come back down to Earth. Not all of them. So you pay a price putting a man in space. Be careful. You may not want to volunteer for that. That colony is going to Mars. 82, Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, K2IW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and thanks to Eric. I hope that I don't have any more dropouts. I know the signal is stronger than it's been in a while. It used to be about an S9 in my location. Now it's S9 plus 10 decibels or minus 63 dBm. So good job, Eric, and I hope my dropouts are a thing of the past. I want to remind everyone the email address to ask questions, suggest topics, and refute anything that I might say is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Everything that I'm talking about will have links, and the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. And we also have a chat room that isn't used anymore. It's chat.ac2gs.com. We'll get you into the chat room. Let me drop for a second. Okay. As Dick mentioned, I really like participation. I like questions. I really do. I would prefer them at the end of each particular little story, and you'll notice when that happens, because rather than let me drop for a second, I'll say let me drop for any questions or comments. And that's when feel free to ask me anything about that particular subject. So let's begin the show. Now, I really like optical illusions, but they're very difficult to get across on the radio. So instead, I've posted on my website, roy.ac2gs, illustration, one optical illusion. You could just go to the page and look at it. It's sitting right there, and it might amuse you. You can do it now. You can do it tomorrow. It'll be there for the foreseeable future at roy.ac2gs.com. And also, if you're a fan, as I am, of optical illusions, they had a competition, and the top 10 winners are listed on a web page that I'm offering as a web link on my page. So if you're a fan of optical illusions, feel free to click that link. It's active right now. Now, lately, I spoke about how the iconoclastic street artist Banksy has been in the news combining art with technology. This next story removes the extraneous artist from the equation entirely and offers you an expensive piece of artwork purely out of the imagination of an artificial intelligence device. A painting created by artificial intelligence sold for $432,000 at the Christie's Princeton Multiples Art Auction in New York. The piece called Portrait of Edmund Bellamy is the first article made entirely by AI to go up for sale at a major art auction. It was expected to fetch between $7,000 and $10,000, making the $432,000 haul quite the shocker. Now, the painting was the work of a type of algorithm known as Generative Adversarial Network that was devised by a Paris-based art collective called Obvious. The group fed the algorithm a data set of about 15,000 portraits painted between the 14th and 20th century. A generator portion of the algorithm used its understanding of those many works of art to start creating its own images. Let me drop for a second. Another part of the system, the discriminator, was tasked with determining the difference between the human-made art and the art being produced by the generator. This process continued until the discriminator could no longer tell the works apart, at which point the art collective decided the work was good enough to sell. The portrait of Edmund Bellamy was one of 11 in a series of portraits of non-existent people created by artificial intelligence. Obvious Art is selling the other portraits for 10,000 euros a pop on its website, so the group may start to rethink this price point after this particular auction. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, to sort of reiterate what Dick just said, researchers are increasingly finding that spending extended periods in space has complicated effects on the human body. Exposure to space radiation is a big concern for long-term astronauts. Life in zero-G could lead to cardiovascular issues and bone loss. Living in enclosed spaces or habitats can also lead to weakened immune systems and the spread of disease. Space can even affect which genes are expressed. But a recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests that we can add another symptom to the long list, deformed brain tissue. In a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a national team of researchers examined MRI images of the brains of 10 Russian cosmonauts before and after they spent extensive periods on the International Space Station, and then again 7 months later for 7 of the men. On average, the cosmonauts, all men in their mid-40s, each spent 189 days in the station experiencing microgravity. Let me drop for a second. Now, according to the study, what they found is that changes took place in 3 different brain tissues. After the space flight, the amount of gray matter, which makes up most of the cortex, or the surface of the brain, was reduced, with an area called the right middle temporal gyrus seeing the most shrinkage at 3.3%. The amount of cerebrospinal fluid, which fills up cavities inside and outside the brain, had increased in volume, maxing out with a 12.9% increase in the third ventricle. The white matter, which is primarily bundles of nerves that send signals throughout the brain and to the spinal cord, appeared unchanged. The follow-up images later showed that the amount of gray matter rebounded, but was still less than the baseline measurement. The amount of cerebrospinal fluid continued to increase, indicating that the cerebrospinal fluid circulation system of the cosmonauts was impacted long after they returned to the white matter appeared to decrease in volume over the same time. The researchers hypothesized that this is also because of the cerebrospinal fluid. As the fluid swelled into the brain during space flight, it forced water into the white matter, increasing the volume of the white matter. Once back under normal gravity conditions, the water in the white matter was released, appearing to shrink it. Let me drop for a second. It's possible the changes may be permanent, or given enough time, their brains might return to normal, but the study indicates that space brain is a real phenomenon. Taken together, our results point to prolonged changes in the pattern of cerebrospinal fluid circulation over a period of at least 7 months following the return to Earth, a researcher for this study said. However, whether or not the extensive alterations shown in the gray and white matter lead to any changes in cognition, that's thought processes, remains unclear at present. cerebrospinal fluid has been on the astromedicine radar screen for a while. One compliant long-term astronaut often have, after their time in orbit, blurred vision, which sometimes resolves itself, but sometimes is permanent. Now, we've talked about this as a serious side effect before on Science Talk, and all that extra fluid pushed against the back of the eyes, flattening and inflaming the optic nerve, is thought to be the cause. It looks like we better design some spinning spacecraft or design robots to man those damn spacecraft designs that we have presently working on. So, lots of luck, everyone. We're not evolved to work in microgravity or even zero gravity. So, I don't know what NASA's next move is going to be. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Have there been any studies to see, for example, at not zero gravity, but say 50% reduced gravity or some percentage of gravity, that the effects completely go away, or do they just gradually reduce as the percentage of normal gravity increases?
I don't think that NASA or anyone on this planet has a way of maintaining a constant mid-gravitational field. You know, you have the Vomit comet, where you can have microgravity or relatively zero gravity for a short duration. But to maintain 50% gravity, again, you'd probably need one of those lovely spacecraft that can revolve and produce about half the force of gravity on an experimental basis. So I don't think it's technically possible yet, as far as I'm aware.
And I was wondering, from the point of view of a theoretical point, for example, how fluid would diffuse to, say, brain tissue? Do they know anything that, say, at a reduced amount of gravity, that diffusion will increase, say, as a square or something of the reduced gravity? Something along that line. Go ahead.
WS2N. Yes, Paul.
There's an experiment that they have on board the station that gives them control to go from zero, you know, all the way up to whatever they want. You know, it's a centrifuge that they use. It's around half a meter in diameter or something. So they do take biological things, put them inside the centrifuge, and they can duplicate, for instance, 1/6 of the gravity for the moon, or 1/3 for Mars, or anywhere in between, because, you know, they are in zero gravity, so they just spin this thing. So I guess they could take brain type of tissue and see if, you know, the fluid reacts in, you know, in that way, you know, inside this machine. But yeah, if you're going to do it with real people, then you're going to need a massive spinning wheel. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, the spinning wheel that you and I could install on the International Space Station. Let me drop it. You know about every one of those modules on the ISS, Paul. I'm going to ask you, what's the biggest volume of a wheel you could put in there that just barely misses the walls? And in theory, you could put a pair of guys in there, or a guy in a dummy load on the other side. But the problem of a wheel that's too small in diameter is that the back of your body would see one amount of gravity, and the front of your body would see a different amount. It'd be a gradient across your body for a small wheel. You'd like the wheel to be really big to give an even amount of gravity. On top of that, if the wheel is small, to get 1G of gravity, for instance, you'd have to spin it so fast the guy would be getting dizzy. So in the best of all worlds, you want the wheel to be huge, like it was in 2001, the movie. Well, there the wheel was almost big enough, and you saw Cad Julia doing exercise, running around in that wheel, almost like a rat in a cage, if you know what I mean. Difficult thing to do. And to test a tiny little sample of brain material, it's not really putting the whole brain under working conditions where the fluid is really coming from the body. Tough test, as I see it. and it's going to be a long time before we get an answer to that, but a rough guess is, I'm going to guess it's partially linear. In other words, half the gravity is going to give you half the problem, is a guess. Over to you, Roy, KQRW.
Well, I agree with you, Dick. I would assume what you're talking is almost like an effect of tidal force on people when the ring is very, very small. And the problem is you don't want static biological material. You want a living, breathing thing. So they probably could put mice in it, but then you'd have to scale up and figure out how mice brains and the cerebrospinal fluid of mice compared to humans. So ultimately, you're going to need to build a much bigger cage and put a real human being in it, at least as far as I can figure.
Now, we did have 1/6 gravity of astronauts on the moon. That's the good news. The bad news is they were only there for 3 days, so it's not a long enough exposure to see this effect. The effect that they measure is when an astronaut is in space for something like a year, as I remember. Isn't that true, Roy? Go ahead.
Looking it up as I speak, because I think it was a little bit less than that. It was 189 days is the date that they give for these things. And yeah, that would be a big problem. There's no way you're going to be able to keep people on the moon that long unless you build something, and that's very problematic as well. I don't know exactly how they're going to be able to test how it falls off as far as gravity. But it's sort of a moot point, because if you're going to build something that's capable of half a G, you probably might as well build it for a whole G.
I'm not sure if Paul's going to correct us on this. I think Mars gives you, is it 1/3 Earth gravity on Mars, Paul?
Yeah, about that. It's 0.38, I think it was the proper number. But yeah, 1/3 G. Don't know. You know, I know I sent you the picture of what NASA proposed in, 7 or 8 years ago in 2011. They proposed the Nautilus program. You know, that was a spinning set of modules that they were going to have, inflated ones similar to the beam that's now present on the International Space Station built by Bigelow. They were going to spin it, and they were going to use it as a test, and eventually, if that worked out, they were going to actually build the spacecraft. A bigger one, but it was dropped because it was almost $4 billion, and you know how NASA is, that $4 billion will turn into like $40 billion before you know it, so they kind of dropped the Nautilus program, but it's, you know, it's still on the books. They put work into it. It just would have to be funded, and there was some writing with it to create 1G. Let me drop it. It would have to be traveling one revolution every 15 seconds, and the radius would have to be 184 feet. So you imagine this 400-foot diameter thing, you know, as big as a football field, rotating every 15 seconds. This thing's going to make a complete turn. That would be quite a project, you know. You're at the end zone 1 second, and then 7.5 seconds, you're at the other end zone, spinning around. That would give you 1G, actually 9.8, they say. So, the structure would have to be extremely strong, because now you're holding 1G, you know, from the center out. So you're not going to be building it with flimsy material. You're going to need something very substantial to hold this thing from flying apart. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
If you remember the movie Space Net in 2001, that's very close to the structure they had Kerr Jr. and his other partner running around in. Very similar. But to construct that, science fiction is easy. To do it in real life, boy, that's going to be expensive. Let me drop it. And 0.38G you get on Mars would make you make some calculations as to how much change in cerebral fluid you're going to get on Mars. But Mars has got a much bigger problem. It takes you more than a year to get there. All kinds of cosmic rays you're going to be exposed to during that year. When you get onto Mars itself, it doesn't have much of a magnetic field, so you're not shielded from the cosmic rays. going to be exposed to a whole lot of ultraviolet because you don't have an ionosphere. You really want to send a robot spacecraft to Mars. You don't want to send a human being. I don't know why a human being would want to dwell there for more than a couple of days as an experiment. And it would be so extremely expensive to get a human being there.